Our final presentation before our question and answer session will be about doctor-lawyer relationships to achieve better health for low-income children with disabilities. And our presenter is Yaquel Sakai.
All right, good afternoon. I have the honor of being the last presenter of the last presentation of the entire conference, so hopefully I can keep your attention. My name is Yael Zakai, and I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C. at the Children's Law Center, and it may be confusing to you what is an attorney doing here at the APHA conference, and to some people, you know, they're used to frequent attorney jokes in, you know, the clinical setting. But I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how we can actually work together to achieve improved health outcomes. And I don't have any disclosures. So to give you a little bit of background on the medical legal collaborative model and ours in particular, this model generated out of Boston Medical Center with Dr. Barry Zuckerman and his family advocacy program. And this was an idea really born of frustration on the part of health professionals who were feeling that in treating low-income children, despite providing them with the best medical care they could, there were continued obstacles and barriers to achieving good health for those children. And those were, a lot of those were issues that could be resolved with some legal intervention. So the solution that they came up with in Boston was to actually bring a legal services attorney on the treatment team as a member of that team to work together to address those problems. And now there are actually 70 medical legal collaboratives across the country, Boston being the first and ours being one of the other early ones. So in Washington, D.C., our collaborative is called the Health Access Project at Children's National Medical Center. And the legal services arm is my organization, the Children's Law Center, which provides free legal services to at-risk children and families. And the goal of our project is really to improve health outcomes for children who use Children's National Medical Center, known in the D.C. area's Children's Hospital and the community pediatric clinics around the city, by providing a broad range of legal services to those patient families actually in the clinic setting. And so we actually, our attorneys actually have offices at community pediatric clinics throughout the D.C. area that are associated with Children's Hospital. So a little bit about the framework of need in the district. So the District of Columbia particularly has a high rate of the population of people living in poverty, and children in particular, you can see pretty skewed compared to national averages. And in fact, because it's so expensive to live in the D.C. area, like it probably is in many of your jurisdictions as well, you can be well above the poverty rate and not be captured by these statistics and still be really struggling day to day, especially in today's economy. So there's a huge level of need in terms of pediatric care for low-income families and trying to marry that with legal services. So here are some different legal areas that actually can impact the health of a family and children in particular. And you can see that there's a pretty broad spectrum, and actually I've been hearing about many of these issues throughout the presentations at this conference, and just yesterday at a roundtable, I was hearing about a study that had been done in Ohio of parents with mental illness who were institutionalized and how what impact that was having on the children. And what the study had found was that really there were a variety of economic, social, and legal barriers that were impacting the situation for those kids. And so, you know, we talked afterwards, and people at the table were like, wow, really, you can bring a lawyer onto the treatment team? So I think it's pretty relevant to a lot of the work that is being done by a lot of people here at the conference. So here are different ways that we actually collaborate and a little bit about what the model looks like. So our attorneys actually educate the healthcare providers on legal issues in a variety of different ways so that they have the information and the tools they need to be good advocates themselves. The healthcare providers in the clinic setting actually screen for legal issues when they are meeting with their patients, and then can refer them to us if there's a even a potential legal need. We can provide case consultation to those providers and legal advice, referrals, and direct representation to the patient families. And then once a legal case is open, that collaboration can continue, and we can provide expertise on the medical needs in the legal case, such as writing letters and reports and testifying at hearings. So we really, from the legal perspective, by partnering with medical professionals, we get an in-house expert, which is really great in terms of advocacy on behalf of kids with disabilities in particular. And we collaborate to provide legal and health trainings to parents and caregivers. We do a lot of these at the main hospital in the district, as well as the community pediatric clinics. And Children's National Medical Center in D.C. has a lot of parent support groups. For example, one for parents of kids with sickle cell anemia. They have a grandparent support group because so many families in D.C. are kids being raised by their grandparents. And so we can go out and target the specific legal needs of that population in doing various trainings. So what are the advantages of actually letting a lawyer into the doctor's office to participate in the treatment team? So having us on site really increases access to legal services in these communities in the first place. For many low-income families, it's the doctor and the hospital are the sort of professionals outside the school that they are seeing most in the community, and also having that level of trust with a professional. I mean, you don't really find that in other professions and government agencies that these families may come into contact every day, but with the pediatrician, oftentimes there's a level of trust and sharing, and these issues can really be flagged. There's quicker access to legal services because we're right on site to provide brief advice. A doctor can actually walk a family down to my office for an intake. Case advocacy can happen right there on the spot if there's an urgent matter, as there often is, especially with kids with special needs. And the medical staff can consult directly with attorneys when legal intervention is needed, and they can actually then do some advocacy on their own. And like I said, we can provide legal advice to patients on the spot. Some more advantages, we participate in clinical rounds and staff meetings, so we really are part of the treatment model, thinking about treatment more holistically than just narrow medical needs. We can more readily collaborate on cases, so throughout the life of a case or the course of a patient's ongoing healthcare needs, we can collaborate together. And then we can also provide trainings for the health professionals themselves, for the pediatricians, the nurses, the psychiatrists, the social workers. We train them on legal issues so that they can enhance their practice with those tools. So I'm going to give you some case examples, and before I go into them to really help you wrap your head around the ways that we can collaborate, I just want to give you the sort of classic case example that is often touted with the medical legal collaborative, and then you'll see how my case examples can be sort of more nuanced or maybe not as obvious. The obvious example that's often given when promoting this model is a child who has asthma and who is getting the best medical care possible from his pediatrician and is using medication regularly, but his asthma isn't improving and he keeps coming back to the pediatrician in the emergency room with severe asthma attacks because there's mold in his apartment, and despite the fact that this has been spotted and the parent has asked that the housing authority and that public housing project to abate that mold or transfer the family, it hasn't been done. And right there's a legal issue. And so in that situation, a pediatrician can bring in a lawyer, and the lawyer can do advocacy, whether it's, you know, writing a letter or making certain demands or actually going to litigation in order to get that family transferred or the mold abated. So that's sort of the classic example, and I'm going to give you a little bit more nuanced examples that particularly relate to kids with disabilities. So here's an example of Jonathan. And this is was actually a client family of mine. Jonathan came to us at age 7 with some complex special needs, and you can imagine out of Children's National Medical Center, you know, that's our referral base, so we often are getting some of the most complex, you know, medical, behavioral, and disability needs all sort of wrapped up in one. So this child has a seizure disorder. He has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and for those of you who may not be familiar with that, that's a genetic disorder that actually makes Jonathan's joints more unstable, and he can dislocate his joints very easily. And he also has pervasive developmental disorder, as was discussed in the last presentation. So he was referred to us by his developmental behavioral pediatrician at Children's Hospital because he was coming into the emergency room over and over and over again as a result of seizures and joint dislocations, you know, prompted by behavioral problems at school associated with his autism spectrum disorder. And also at age 7, he didn't have any reading or writing skills whatsoever. And actually, the doctors at Children's, the ER doctors joked with them that they should name a wing of the ER at Children's after Jonathan because he was in there so often. So here are some steps that we took to try to get him some help. So we advocated right alongside with the pediatrician through the special education process to get an appropriate individualized educational program or IEP for Jonathan that included the specialized instruction he needed, but a very nuanced behavioral plan, a safety plan around his play on the playground and in the school, counseling, occupational therapy and physical therapy, which can help with the joint instability around his Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and an appropriate school placement. So the health outcome. So Jonathan now attends a school with specialized services for children with autism spectrum disorders, which includes a variety of very structured behavioral supports and nursing services at the school to support him in regards to his medical needs. And since he's gotten that school placement, he has not had one single seizure or dislocation or emergency room visit. And he's finally learning to read and write. So simply with doing the legal advocacy together with the pediatrician through the IEP process to make sure that the school district was actually protecting this family's needs and Jonathan's very special needs, you know, we were able to actually improve his health outcome through that advocacy. So here are some other types of case examples and ways that doctors and lawyers can collaborate together. So we worked on a housing case with the doctors at Children's where a child who was wheelchair bound, every time it rained or snowed in DC, he wasn't able to get to school because in between his house and the sidewalk where he got picked up from his bus was a huge grassy area, and it was just completely a muddy field every time it rained, and for days he wouldn't be able to get across the lawn to get to school, and his parent couldn't push him in the wheelchair because it was just too muddy. So we got the landlord to build an access way for him so he could get to school regardless of the weather. We've secured specialty nursing services in school actually for a variety of kids, including kids where not having that could be life-threatening, such as this child. We've done a lot of access to healthcare work, so that's really working with the health insurance companies, sometimes unfortunately against the health insurance companies, to secure, you know, needed services, especially to try to keep kids in the community who would otherwise be, you know, facing repeated acute hospitalizations or long-term residential treatment. So this was another child with a variety of needs who actually had been had received gunshot wounds as a teenager and was paraplegic and suffering from an ulcer because he didn't have the right type of wheelchair, and severe depression as a result. And so we advocated for new equipment for him as well as a variety of services and all in an effort to keep him out of residential treatment. We do a lot of family law work, so we secured guardianship for a parent on behalf of her daughter who has a variety of severe disabilities and needed assistance in terms of decision-making long-term. We help a lot of families get the public benefits they need, whether those benefits have been denied or the amounts that the families receive are not adequate. And so we help with a lot of SSI cases, especially because of the population we're working with, primarily of children with disabilities. And we do systemic advocacy together with the health professionals at Children's. So recently, a Medicaid managed care organization in the district terminated therapeutic after-school services for 40 children all at the same time. And the doctors at Children's Hospital were getting these letters, you know, all of a sudden that their patients were being terminated from this service without any individualized explanation. So we were able to advocate together, and those were all kids who were at risk of continued repeated acute psychiatric hospitalization if they didn't have this therapeutic program that they were a part of. And so we were able to advocate together with the MCO to get the kids reinstated in that program. So this is our impact over time so far. So we've served a few hundred families in a variety of legal matters, and you can see there's a very broad spectrum, and really where we focus just depends on the referrals we get from the health professionals. And in the district, there's what's notoriously known to be a very broken special education system, which I think actually was referenced in the presidential debates recently. And so we get a lot of referrals for special education legal advocacy, which may not be as prevalent in some of your areas, but in DC is a huge issue. And so we partner very closely with the doctors on education issues, but as you can see, a variety of other types of cases to benefit the overall health of the children and families. And I have with me, if anybody wants, a handout about our collaborative that has contact information for us, and I'll leave it up here on one of the chairs, and you can grab it on your way out if you'd like. And thank you so much for your time on this very last session, and for all of my co-panelists.
Okay, excellent panel. I think everybody can concur. We ended on a very high note. We're open for questions now, and so if you go to the microphone, that'd be great. I'm leaving this slide up because otherwise it doesn't get recorded, and the panelist who you're addressing can come up here to the podium so it can be recorded.
I have a question for the last presenter. When a family comes in looking for guardianship, how do you work with them to help them understand that there are often many options besides full guardianship? Because I find that many parents think that it's all or nothing, which could be disastrous for the individual.
Thanks for your question. Before we take any of our legal cases, including ones such as guardianship, where actually, you know, the rights of the child or teenager could really be implicated, we do a pretty thorough assessment of the legal merits of the case, and that includes a lot of time talking with the health professionals and providers who are working with the child and the family, and getting extensive records. And we explore all of the options with the caregiver who comes to us for legal assistance, and trying to make sure that, to the best of our abilities, what we're advocating for is, something that people would agree with is best for the child. I mean, sometimes there are disagreements about that, and in those situations, maybe everybody at the table should have a lawyer and not just the person we're representing. But we're partnering pretty closely with the healthcare professionals, so we're trying to do a lot of education about the different options with the caregivers that come to us. And sometimes what they come to us needing ends up being something totally different than what we end up pursuing. The other thing that often happens is that when a parent might or caregiver might come to us with guardianship needs, there may be 100 other things going on that are really the problem in terms of the kid's health. And there are ways that if the kid was getting an appropriate education at school or appropriate therapeutic supports, they might actually be able to make their own decisions. So we try to sort of tackle the problem very holistically, and a lot of times we start with one you know, very single legal issue, but our intake process and our sort of holistic case advocacy allows us to spot the whole spectrum of legal issues. And we have clients, client families who we've worked with for 6 or 7 years because issues just keep popping up with all of the children and the family and a variety of legal issues. And so if we can tackle a guardianship type problem more holistically, we definitely will. Okay.
Actually, I was wondering how the funding was developed to bring the legal into the healthcare setting, because Medicaid and private medical insurance doesn't pay for that, and I kind of think the federal government really frown on taking healthcare dollars to pay for an attorney.
Yep, it's definitely not healthcare dollars that's funding our work. And we aren't providing healthcare services explicitly, but, you know, we are supporting the work of the doctors and trying to achieve health outcomes. But, you know, in the end, we are a separate entity, the Children's Law Center. We're a 501c3. We actually have other projects beyond our medical legal collaborative to do work in the community. And our medical legal collaborative specifically is funded by foundation grants. And so there are some of those are the same funders that, you know, healthcare providers may be competing for dollars for. So those funders have made a decision that this is just an important service that's needed in order to really provide sustained health outcomes for these families. But we don't take federal dollars or local government dollars at all. And sometimes we are adversarial to, you know, especially local government and government agencies in a variety of ways to try to achieve the health outcomes. So you're right, that's not something that they would necessarily support, but we are doing actually a lot of policy work to try to make sure that our city and our families are actually receiving maximum benefit from the Medicaid dollars that are coming into our city, which is a huge problem in D.C. So we're actually in favor of doing whatever we can to make sure that the dollars that are supposed to be coming in from the feds actually make it to our families.
I'm wondering how often you deal with domestic violence issues and if you have staff within your center that deals with specialized immigration issues.
Yeah, those are two areas of law where there are a lot of organizations in D.C. doing that work. In particular, and so we have tried to really focus on those issue areas where nobody else will provide those legal services. So if a domestic violence issue arises in a case that we're already working on, we may be able to tackle it ourselves, but if an intake comes in on domestic violence issues, we often refer it out to one of the several organizations in D.C. doing that work very well. And immigration, we specifically don't tackle because that's a huge issue area, and a lot of those cases are brought in the district, being sort of the federal seat. And we have sort of these specialty areas in education and healthcare access, and so we refer those cases out, but we never turn a family away empty-handed. So if a family comes to us with an issue that isn't, you know, for example, we don't do criminal law specifically either. A lot of the kids that we work with may find themselves in the delinquency system, and we'll go in and we'll speak to the judges on behalf of the family and do our advocacy and make sure that the judges, if it's appropriate, understand the special needs of the child and how that may be related. But if the case comes to us specifically in an area where we don't practice, we won't turn the family away ever empty-handed. We do a very targeted legal referral, and we've built very close relationships with the other legal services organizations to be able to do that.
I actually don't know the answer to that question. We actually didn't look at that specifically, what the leading causes were. I'm sure there are other studies that have done work on that data that would provide that information. I know that the PI that I work under has done a lot of studies similar to that. So, yeah, I'm not sure. Sorry.
Thank you to all the presenters. I'm really glad I stayed. I learned a lot.
I do have a question for the last presenter. And I wondered, when you advocate, say, with a school district, do you have any sense of whether that might generalize to other children? Like, if you've had to fight for something to be in an IEP, might the school district not fight another family so much because of your efforts? I'm just thinking, did that build some generality in kids getting their needs addressed?
Yeah, we for sure, just having lawyers at the table in the IEP process in a school district where kids largely are not receiving an adequate level of service, just having lawyers at the table, it's an unfortunate consequence. I mean, I wish we weren't getting all these special ed referrals. There's so many other legal issues we could be focusing on, but it does really provide accountability at the table. And the same thing goes with, the health insurance companies we work with, which in D.C. is largely the Medicaid managed care organizations we work with, just sort of knowing that lawyers are out there watching out for this, and that children's hospital doctors they're the largest pediatric provider in D.C., and they serve tens of thousands of kids every year in a pretty small city, and that they're spotting these issues time and time again and bringing them to the attention of lawyers. It really is just providing a level of accountability. We also have several class action lawsuits going on in the district that the Children's Law Center hasn't actually brought. We're an individual legal services provider. We don't do the large class action work. But having that legal leverage when we go into knowing that many of our clients are part of various plaintiffs' classes in the different class action lawsuits also provides accountability. So it's definitely generalized, and I think it's not only raising the level of special education in the city, but also the level of education in the city, because they're committed. The school district is really, with a new chancellor we have, really committed to trying to find solutions to keep kids in special education in the city, not being sent away to residential placements, not being sent away to Virginia and Maryland to, expensive non-public school placements where those kids are very segregated from the general ed population. But we largely haven't had other alternatives in D.C. until now, and I think, for unfortunately or fortunately, the presence of lawyers has contributed a lot to those changes.
Thank you all very much. We appreciate it.